What if you are someone's answered prayer, even though yours feel unanswered? Now, when we look at a phrase like that, most of us have probably heard some version of the first part of that. You are someone's answered prayer. And we're used to hearing and maybe even saying things like that, right? After all, God is sovereign and almighty. And in his wisdom, he often works through people to encourage, to instruct, to help, to bless. But really, it's that second part of the statement that we need to think a little more deliberately about. What if you are someone's answered prayer? Yes, even though your own at the time may feel unanswered. What if you are in a situation or a difficulty? God, please get me out of this. But at the same time, in the midst of that difficulty, God is using you to answer someone else's prayers. Imagine the following scenario. You're in an office workplace. It's very difficult. The boss is challenging your coworkers, many of them anyway, and it's stressful, and sometimes you lose sleep at night. But slowly over time, you get to know some of the people a little bit. You start to build some friendships to a certain degree, and one night after a stressful day, some of you go out, get wings after work, and you're talking, and you have this conversation with someone, and this person in this little side conversation you're having reveals to you that they are really so low at this point in their life, they feel as if they're out of hope. And you see that as an opportunity. You walk through that door, and with grace and kindness, you share something about your own faith with that person in that moment. Now, at the time, you don't realize, but 20 years down the road, you're talking with that same person. You reflect back on the conversation that you have, and they reveal to you, that was actually a turning point in my life. You had been praying at home, God, please get me out of this situation. They had been praying, God, I need some help. And you happen to be that help. There's another person in the office, kind of quiet. You're not really sure, but over time, you start to develop a relationship around the coffee machine, around the lunch hour when reports aren't due. You don't realize this at the time, but that person, part of the reason they're withdrawn somewhat is because they actually were abused by an older step-sibling when they were young. They have a really hard time trusting people. But they start to trust you. You develop a friendship, and that person actually starts to realize that everyone isn't out to get something from someone else. There are genuine people in the world. So all the while you've been praying, God, get me out of this situation, in the midst of that situation, that person also had been praying for help, and God was using you to answer their prayers. See, here's the thing we need to remember. In difficulty, yes, God is with us. He is also with other people through us. What if you are someone's answered prayer, even though you feel yours are sometimes unanswered? Well, we are journeying through the book of Daniel. And today we arrive at chapter 5. Daniel is this man of single, solitary devotion. We're basically doing a chapter per week, mostly. But one of the things I personally have appreciated about this series, as we've gone through, is that Daniel and his experience teaches us how to deal with difficult things, serious, difficult things. And we've been coming across this time and time again as we go through each chapter. How do I trust and follow God even when things are really challenging or painful in my life? How do I trust and follow God, even when things are sometimes actually dangerous? How do I trust and follow God when it feels like my own prayers are unanswered? So if you've got your Bible, I invite you to open to Daniel chapter 5. I'm reading from the ESV. We're going to put the words up here on the screen as we go through as well. Let's hear the majestic, beautiful word of God. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. So, first of all, this is the first time we've heard from this king. The first four chapters, it's been King Nebuchadnezzar, but he is now gone. So his reign is over, and now this is a man named Belshazzar. Now, later on, we will learn that this is the last year in his reign, so we actually know where this happens historically. It's 539 BC, specifically October, 539 BC. but we need to kind of address a bit of a historical puzzle, because some people will say, well, based on historical records, there was Nebuchadnezzar, and then there was someone named Nabonidus. And we're not sure that, you know, Belshazzar was king after that. Here's what I think is going on. What happens is there are historical records that say that Nabonidus, he actually became ill and was actually out of the country for a long period of time in Arabia. and that he appointed as co-regent, acting king, his son, who is Belshazzar. So that's most likely what is going on here, which also makes sense because the Aramaic word here for king is sometimes translated as governor, so it makes sense. But back to the story. So the scene is there's a thousand of people, there's drinking of wine, presumably gulping it more than they should, and the Aramaic here seems to suggest that. The king's there, his wives are there, and his concubines, so you already know that things are happening that should not be happening. A man's to have sex with his wife and no one else, but there's all these concubines here, and the major concern is what they are drinking the wine from. Big part of the story. So when you recall when we started the series, way back in Daniel 1, verse 2, when Nebuchadnezzar come into Jerusalem in the first place, and what they do is they take Daniel and so many others, they send them into exile, but we learn that they actually go into the temple and they take the vessels from the temple. So this is cups, this is goblets, this is plates consecrated for sacred use in the temple, and they've taken them back to Babylon, and that's actually what they're using here. It is an act of sacrilege. Verse 3. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Oh no, it gets worse, this act of sacrilege. They are using it to praise pagan gods, and this adds to the sacrilege. Think of how offensive this would have been. Imagine we have this communion table and we consecrate this, we dedicate this to holy purposes, which we have. Imagine we take this Bible of mine here, we dedicate this to holy purposes. And then let's imagine some foreign nation comes in, enslaves many of us, forces us to go into exile, to live and serve as servants in that nation. They destroy this church, but they take all our sacred items with them to the new country. And then some great night, they're having this drunken party. And they say, hey, let's light some candles and make a sacrifice to Satan. Oh, but let's light the candles on that communion table from that church that we sacked. Hey, let's consult some dead spirits and use a Ouija board. By the way, those are demons deceiving you. And let's put the Ouija board out on that Bible that we also took from that sanctuary. It adds to the sacrilege, and we would be offended, rightly so. And that is the case with the Jews in this story. Verse 5. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. And so all of a sudden, this huge hand appears. It's clear. It's by the lampstand. Everyone sees what it is. And the king is scared. He's frightened. Okay, what's the deal? Now, whose hand is this? Let's ask. Well, could it be the hand of God? It's possible. We learn in Exodus 31 that God wrote the Ten Commandments with his, quote, finger. It's quite possible. I actually think that this is a case of dark foreshadowing. So in ancient warfare, the victorious army would often go and looking at all the dead people they had killed, and they would cut off the right hand of the dead. And they would then make a huge pile of these bloody, decapitated right hands. Now, why would they do that? Well, it's easier to make a body count. How many people have we killed? They cut off the right hand. And so what I think here is because of this desecrating act of sacrilege, we know later in the story that the king's own life will be judged and taken from him. I think this is a case of dark foreshadowing. It's meant to represent, I think, the king's own hand. And that's kind of bloody imagery. Hold on for a second. Now for something more pleasant, okay? This image here is a depiction that is somewhere in this church of this very scene. There's Belshazzar pointing, there's the hand, there's people, there's some wine, etc. Does anyone know where this is located, by the way? Nina can't answer. Anyone want to know where? Any guesses? The library, that's right. The next slide shows you. That's the bottom right panel in the library. Way to go, Donna Rattan. Nina spends a lot of time in there, so she didn't. I should also say that Ben had his hand up at the back as well. Now, in this picture, it is actually it's a much more serene version of things. People are kind of smiling and happy as if it's a nice party. Probably more serene and happy than they would have been in the original scene. But hey, who wants a picture of some half-drunken, idol-worshipping pagans hanging in the church? Not me. So I much rather that version of the story. By the way, made by the Jolly Nimble Fingers in 2009. Interesting. Okay, continuing, verse 7. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers.
The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. So here again, he brings in the quote-unquote wise men of Babylon. These are his brain trusts, but no one can really figure out what is going on here, perhaps in a foreign script. Maybe it's just interpretation that is beyond them. Verse 10, the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, and here the word father is a generic word. It could also mean ancestor. So technically Nebuchadnezzar is his grandfather. But there is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers because an excellent spirit, knowledge and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show you the interpretation. So in the midst of the confusion, the queen comes in, and this is most likely actually the queen mother, okay? So she comes in, she's been around for a while, and she reminds him of Daniel. So Daniel here is named, and he enters into the story, and he's clearly special. He has some sort of divine knowledge about him. But honestly, it kind of makes you wonder, why do they keep forgetting about Daniel, right? He's already come in multiple times. He's helped King Nebuchadnezzar. What's the deal? Why do they keep forgetting? Here's why. Here's a timeline. So on the screen on the left, that represents the original attack upon Jerusalem when Daniel and his friends were captured and taken to exile. And the year was 605 BC, King Nebuchadnezzar. So assuming that Daniel was about 15 years old, as scholars say, fast forward to the year of this story, 539 BC, with King Belshazzar, that makes Daniel now in his early 80s. Daniel is now a senior citizen. How many of us, when we think about Daniel in the lion's den, we picture some young man in his 20s or maybe 30s. That story hasn't even happened yet. That's next week. Daniel is in his 80s when he's in the lion's den. He is now a senior citizen. Think of it like this. Imagine someone born in the year 2000. They get captured in the year 2015, and then something happens to them. We hear about them again in 2082. That's kind of the time horizon of what we're going. So that explains why they don't really know. It takes the queen mother, she was around when Nebuchadnezzar was king, to remind them about this Daniel. Now, when kings change and when governments change, and it happens today too, let's say there's a new prime minister, a new cabinet, new president, whomever, some of the civil service remains the same, but the political aides change. Whoever is the people who are, you know, loyal to the king or the new queen or whoever it happens to be, and is on board with their agenda. So what most likely happened is Daniel's authority and influence has kind of waned. He's been around for a couple of decades. He's in the court, but he doesn't have the same position as before. Verse 13, then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, now listen to what he says. It makes sense that Daniel hasn't been around for a while. You are that Daniel. Right? He's heard stories. One of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Daniel has heard all this before. He will be given all these expensive gifts. He will be made the third ruler. Now, why the third ruler? Well, if our accounting of history makes sense and Nabonidus is away in Arabia, and then basically we have Belshazzar acting as co-regent, that's one and two. That would mean Daniel is third under them. Okay, continuing, verse 17. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him all peoples, nations, languages, trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed. Whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. When his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. So that might seem like a lot to you, but those who were here last week, that's exactly what happens in chapter 4. Daniel is just reminding him what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. It wasn't until he recognized God that he was brought up to his former position. Verse 22. And you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house you have brought in before you. And you and your lords, your wives, your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. This is a dangerous thing to say. This line of kings threatens to rip people's arms out of their sockets, destroy their homes. This is a dangerous thing to say. It takes courage to say this. Daniel names two things specifically. First, he calls the king on his arrogance. Second, he says that using sacred vessels from the temple to praise pagan gods is a thing you should not do. He calls him specifically on that act of sacrilege. One of my former Old Testament professors wrote a book fairly recently, Brian Irwin. He says this, next slide. In the Old Testament, idolatry is the ultimate deal breaker. And so God is slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. But after a while, time runs out. It's the deal breaker. Continuing, verse 24. Then from his presence, the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed. Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parson. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances, found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. So here are these words and what they mean. So there's kind of a word play with the Aramaic going on. Mene means numbered, meaning the king's days are numbered. Tekel means weighs. You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. In other words, you have been judged negatively. Parson means divided, meaning his kingdom will weaken. It will be divided among the Medes and the Persians. And that word that is used third is also kind of sounds like Persian. So it kind of makes sense historically. And so what I would say, in kind of layman's terms, it's saying this, your end is coming soon. Your end is coming soon. You have been judged. Your kingdom will weaken and fall apart. What will the king do? It's not good news. Verse 29. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck. And the proclamation was made about him that he should be third ruler in the kingdom. Even though it's bad news, he does what he says, gives Daniel the rewards, even though Daniel doesn't really want them. Verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. And Darius, or as they would have said, Darius, the Mede, received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Now, earlier I had said that the handwriting on the wall, the hand was a case of dark foreshadowing, and I think that's the case. By the way, this is where the expression comes from, the writing on the wall. That's where it comes from, this story. The idea is that something is a foregone conclusion. Well, because of the king's act of sacrilege, it's a foregone conclusion that he will be judged negatively. And so I think what we're seeing is that hand was really kind of a representation of the king's hand, because that very night he would lose his life. And in fact, when he dies, it's actually the end of the superpower. The Babylonian superpower, because the next superpower is the Persians. And this night records the night when the superpowers changed. It's interesting historically that there are a couple of Greek historians, Xenophon and Herodotus, who say that on the night Babylon fell in the city, there were large drinking parties, which is exactly what we find confirmed here in Daniel 5. The last verse tells us that Darius received the kingdom. This was most likely a governor who reported to King Cyrus of Persia, the new superpower. Perhaps Darius was the Babylonian name of Cyrus. It's hard to be sure. Either way, one kingdom falls, another rises. This is the word of the Lord. Now, earlier when I was explaining the passage, I passed quickly over verse 17, and perhaps at the time you thought, you know, we should probably
explain or hear a bit more about that. And the reason I skipped over it, because I wanted to share it with you now. Verse 17, Daniel says this to the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing." Daniel does not seem either happy or impressed. Why do we know this? Well, he does not employ the ancient convention. When you go into a king's presence, it's normal to compliment the king, to say something nice and praiseworthy. Daniel doesn't even do that. In fact, quite the opposite. He's actually kind of rude to him. He basically says, "Keep your gifts for yourself. I could care less about them." Now, why would Daniel have this attitude? Think about it. The king, who represents a superpower that has taken him captive, destroyed much of what he has known and loved, including, by this point, the temple in Jerusalem, made him serve for decades upon decades of his life, who most likely castrated him when he came to Babylon in the first place, destroyed any hope for children or grandchildren, and who has most recently engaged this king in a horrific act of sacrilege. He wants Daniel's help. Daniel's looking at a king who is probably the age of who his own grandchild would be. Perhaps that is a difficult reminder to him. No gift will make him happy. No reward will erase what has happened. He is now a senior citizen. Most of his time on earth is gone. We never hear about his friends again, by the way. Ever notice? We're never going to hear about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel's in his 80s. They're probably passed away. And probably he is feeling incredibly, incredibly alone. And so he stands there stone-faced and matter-of-fact, and he simply tells the king what he wants to know. Now, here's what I want to invite us to consider in light of today's theme. Daniel was a man of fervent prayer. We know that. Next week, we will look at chapter 6, verse 10. Daniel prays at least three times a day, and when he does so, he looks out the window and he looks toward Jerusalem. What was he praying for? Was he praying for some sort of deliverance? Was he praying for his fellow Jews scattered out throughout the land that God would rescue all of them? Was he maybe praying for a better life? At the same time that he was praying, all his fellow patriots, his fellow Jews, would have been out, scattered as they were throughout Babylonia. They would have been praying for things as well. Maybe they were praying for the kind of hope that only someone like Daniel could provide. Maybe they were praying that the king would change that murderous law back in chapter 3, something that Daniel was actually able to accomplish. Maybe they were actually praying that there would be someone who would come along who would speak the truth and the glory of God to these tyrannical kings, something that Daniel actually did on more than one occasion. What if Daniel was their answered prayer, even if he felt his own were unanswered? And Daniel, I see at least four things that are instructive to us, and I'll leave these with you. The first is this: it's not all about you. As we think about our faith, as modern North Americans, it's so easy. My faith is about me and Jesus. Yes, it is about you and Jesus, but it isn't just about you and Jesus. There are other people. Other people, not only God, but you. To think bigger about God. Daniel believed in a great big God who did big things that were happening beyond the immediate perspective in front of his face. Sometimes the analogy is used of an ant and Einstein. Do we really expect a little ant on the ground to understand Einstein's theory of relativity? No, it's an ant. Well, in the analogy, guess what? We're the ant, and God is Einstein. And we know from his word that God is always good, holy, wise, loving, and true. So do we believe in a great big God who's going to be doing incredible things beyond our comprehension sometimes? Or do we only believe in a little God who is going to do things I understand and make me happy today? Evelyn Underhill has said, "If God were small enough to be fully understood, he wouldn't be big enough to be worshiped." Three, play the long game. I'm not sure I need to explain this one. Play the long game. We live in a time of microwaves, instant messaging, and Amazon Prime. But God does not work on our timelines. Four, keep helping and hoping. As mentioned, Daniel was not impressed. He didn't want the king's gifts. Who cares? Keep them, he basically says. But he continued to serve God and others, knowing that the Lord would honor and use his words and actions, even though he couldn't see how that might play out over the long term. Long haul, and that is the exact same thing with us. In difficulty, we need to remember as modern Christians that yes, God is with us, but he is also with others through us. What if you are someone's answered prayer, even though you feel yours are unanswered? And when I say this, don't get me wrong. If you're in a situation of some sort of abuse, this is not a justification to remain in that situation. I think it's bad. I think you should get out. This is not about that. This is about something different. This is about thinking in a bigger way about God and what he is capable of doing, not just in the world generally, but in our lives specifically.
So final thought, let me highlight another phrase that Daniel used in verse 23. I skipped over this at the time as well, that the king has not honored the God in whose hand is your breath. Isn't that beautiful? He's like, how can Belshazzar not honor the God in whose hand in his breath? In other words, who holds his very breath in his hand. And that is also our God. The God who is at once almighty and sovereign at the same time is so close, so intimate with us, that he actually holds our breath in his hand. This is the God we serve and who redeems us freely in Jesus Christ, not only in this life, but into the next. Paul Schurer, the great Lutheran preacher, says that part of the joy of his faith is trusting in God in the midst of some great darkness and waiting for the light to break. Trusting God in the midst of some great darkness and waiting for the light to break. And so the same thing is true for us as we deal with our various kinds of darkness. May we trust God and wait for the light to break, because it will. Amen.